any stick of gum, nickel soda pop. Dime in the jukebox, quarter record pop. Penny, nickel, dime, quarter. That's all it takes. We're gonna have a ball, rock and roll you all on a teenage date. A penny, nickel, dime, quarter. Don't make me wait. And when the band gets hit, we're gonna make you live on a teenage date.
Penny, nickel, dime, quarter from 1956, before Silhouettes, La-Di-Da, Freddie Cannon, and the Four Seasons. Bob Crewe was quite a rock and roller, but he was so much more than that. I'm Ronnie Allen. 6 years ago, I was honored to do a radio program with Bob, and at the very outset, I asked him, when you were very young, were you thinking that you wanted to be in the record business? I'll never forget his answer.
I didn't really think that, but I wanted so much to be able to dance with Shirley Temple. I wanted to be her partner. You know, I mean, I was in love with Shirley Temple, my first crush. And that's where I wanted to be. I wanted to be up on that big silver screen dancing with her. And, you know, it got me to where I got, which was not on the silver screen, but in a silver studio.
Well, now you know why the Four Seasons, as the Wonder Who, eventually recorded on the good ship Lollipop. And as you listen to what we're about to present, you will learn many other things. This is Bob Crewe, the master and the music. And you're about to hear from 38 people whom I personally interviewed who wanted to pay tribute to this amazing man. Leading off with a gentleman who knew Bob as well as anybody. This is Bob's brother, Dan Crewe. Thank you so much, Dan, for agreeing to open and close this special presentation.
Well, you're very, very welcome, Ronnie. Thank you for this wonderful opportunity to make the appropriate tribute to my brother.
Were you older or younger than Bob?
I'm 4 years younger than Bob, but even Bob would have told you this in many, many respects. I acted as the older brother. My role always was as the advisor and the organizer and, you know, sort of the executive to the operation, whereas my brother was the creative entity, creative genius.
Prior to getting involved in a business sense, when you're like teenagers or even before that, did Bob give any indication to you that he had a specific fondness for any particular type of music or any clue to what was eventually going to happen with Bob?
Well, Bob was always very musically inclined. He sang in every kind of production you can imagine. He used to organize shows with kids in grammar school and then in high school in our house, practicing on our piano and putting together reviews. And this is back in our days living in Belleville, New Jersey, where three of the Four Seasons are also from, although we never knew then.
Yeah.
They lived in another area of Belleville, but ironically, years later, Bob's relationship with originally the three guys before Bob Gaudio was that he hired them quite often to sing background on some of his other records.
Maybe initially he had dreams of becoming a singer, primarily, perhaps?
Well, he was a very serious singer, and he did have a lot of records over the years that he put out as a singer. He had a turntable hit with the Whiff and Poof song.
Well, that was actually after Mack the Knife. It was in a similar style.
Very much of a Bobby Darin style.
Well, we opened this tribute with Penny, Nickel, Dime, Quarter, and we're going to close with the one that you just mentioned, the Whiff and Poof song. Growing up with your brother, did the two of you get along most of the time?
Yes. However, you have to understand that Bob started his life and career away from home by the time he was 17 or 18 years old. That meant that I was only 13 or 14 when he left home. And the fact is, our lives didn't cross strongly again until I joined him in 1961, and he asked if I would come in and put together a company, which he did not have at that time.
So what exactly was your role when you started working with your brother? Was it a financial role, a managerial role?
Yes, it was managerial, financial, and I developed an expertise in publishing. I always referred to my dealing with my brother during those years as holding on the reins of the horse that was racing down the track and trying to hold him back so that we didn't go into complete destruction, because creative people tend to be way off the track as a rule. But at the same time, recognizing that you have to make sure that they have enough head so that they can do the creative things without destroying the operation. So we had this push-pull throughout the entire time, which really was from 61 to 68, which is the highlight of the Four Seasons. Diane Renee, Eddie Rambo, Norma Tanega, Mitch Ryder and the Detroit Wheels. It was a very, very wonderfully exciting time.
Were you the personal manager of any of the acts that we've mentioned?
Yeah, in the early, early days, Bob and I managed the Four Seasons. We owned the publishing and management company. Eventually, we hired some people to work with us in the management company.
Right.
But when the Four Seasons really took off, we realized that we were not really equipped to maintain the management. It's a specialty business of which we were not personally really that interested in doing.
Did you manage Diane Renee?
We did the same thing with Diane, and we did the same thing with Mitch Ryder and the Detroit Wheels. Eventually, all of these acts, we decided not to be in management anymore. We let go of their contracts and management and turned them over to other people.
Oliver is another one.
Oliver came in at the tail end when I left the company. But yes, Oliver, we had made the deal with Paramount Pictures and Dot Records, and Oliver was sort of the first projects we did.
Was your brother a musician?
He could read music, and he did read sheet music, and he was able to perform as a singer, and he could pick out a tune on a piano, but he was not an accomplished musician, that's for sure. But he definitely had years and years and years where he participated in what I would call musical drama.
Dan, I want to thank you for opening this tribute to your brother Bob, and as I mentioned before, you will be closing it as well.
You're welcome. I'm looking forward to hearing the rest of the show. Let's go with it, Ronnie.
This special tribute is a celebration of the life and legacy of Bob Crewe. In addition to Dan, we're going to meet 37 others who wanted to share their memories of this amazing man, whose biggest hit, which listed him as the artist on a recording, was Music to Watch Girls By, a song written by orchestrator, arranger, and composer Sid Raymond. The orchestra on that classic platter was the Bob Crewe Generation. When I interviewed Bob back in 2008, we talked about that memorable recording. Bob, you did have a recording under your own name that made the top 40 in which you didn't sing a note.
No, I might have been humming way in the background.
You may have been humming, but you had to create a generation
right.
To do this.
It was all my studio men, the ones that I work with all the time. We got together and made a record out of the Pepsi-Cola commercial.
Yeah. Did Hutch Davy conduct
that? Yes. I was working quite a bit with Hutch in those days. I loved working with him. He was very fresh, always. He did the arrangement, but when we would sit on a song like that, you know, I mean, I'd be singing violin lines. That's the way I worked with all my musicians, all my arrangers. I'd draw pictures, you know, on his manuscript. I would put lightning bolts, you know, or whatever it was that I imagined, I saw or heard. Be clouds and birds flying, you know, where the violins come in. So I'd be scribbling all over the chart. Charlie Colello has a couple of those that I did that to, and I think he framed one of them. It's in his house in Florida.
How did you come up with the name Bob Crewe Generation?
I think it was part of the times that we were in, and I wanted to be part of the generation that was, you know, so hot in the 60s. And, of course, with the Diet Right Pepsi-Cola that they were promoting, they were saying Pepsi Generation, and I just lifted it. Thank you. And now most people think that Pepsi got Generation from Bob Crewe, but it was the other way around.
Throughout this tribute, you are going to hear portions of that recording between each of the segments, starting now. What an honor it is for me to present a man who, for several years, was Bob Crew's production and songwriting partner. When you have a chance, please pull out some of your old 45s from the 50s that have Bob Crew's name on the label. You'll also see his name on the label. His name is Frank Slay.
Good morning, Ronnie.
Good morning, Frank. And how did you and Bob Crew first get together?
Bob Crew was a high school football player and man about Lavalette, New Jersey. Came into New York, went into the modeling business, was selling ties at Bronzini store there in Manhattan. And I was a novice from Dallas, Texas, who arrived on the bus and thought he was a songwriter and showed his songs to different people in New York, Atlantic Records. They liked him and so forth. I needed somebody to sing on demos for me, so I got his name through an old friend of mine from Texas, Harold Griffin, who also was from Dallas and came into New York. And so there we were. Harold introduced us, and we got together, and he made demos of songs that I had written, and it was obvious to me that he was a gifted songwriter. He contributed a lot of things. Finally, it just dawned on me to say, hey, Bob, we might as well write this stuff together. There's no point in doing my songs. Let's do our songs. And that's exactly what we did.
The first big hit song that you and Bob wrote together was Silhouettes.
Bob and I had a list of titles. Throughout Bob's career, he did this. And we would work on the title that kind of came to us. We were working, sitting over there by his piano in his apartment, and we would look through the titles, and we would just pick out one, and that's really the way Silhouette started. I was working at a British Information Service in Manhattan on the Rockefeller Center, and I wrote most of the lyric on my off time up at British Information Service. I played the piano, and Bob contributed the music and what lyrics needed to be finished. He did. Mm-hmm. And on making the record, he was very important to it. He did the silhouette. He came up with that and a lot of the lines in the song and corrected a lot of my lines. And I suppose it was his melody as much as mine, maybe more his.
What about the Rays? How did you actually meet the Rays?
The Rays had just been turned down at Jaguar Records. As they were coming out the door, Bob and I said, well, you haven't failed our audition.
Interesting, Frank, that you should mention that, because I have on my other phone Hal Miller, the lead singer of the Rays. And Hal, what do you remember about your big turndown?
I forgot the gentleman's name that was running Jaguar, but he had us run through a couple of things that other groups had made, like Ling Ting Tong by the Five Keys, by the Clovers, and groups like that.
But Jaguar
turned us down, told us we did not have the talent nor the sound. He said, come back when you're more developed.
But the good news is that Frank Slay and Bob Crew were in the area and had heard your audition.
They were downstairs when we took the elevator down. Frank had a grin on his face. He just said, you guys sound good. Ignore that guy up at Jaguar. He can record you in less than a week or 2 weeks.
You went from an audition failure to automatic success.
Automatic success.
The other three members of the Rays were Walter Ford, David Jones, and Harry James. And I believe you did a couple of songs at your first session, and one of them was Daddy Cool.
I did like Daddy Cool.
Daddy Cool.
And Walt did a good job on Daddy Cool. I think he did a very good job on it. So I got Silhouettes, believe it or not. I was stuck with Silhouettes. So.
Gee, I feel so sorry for you.
thank you. Bob said, Hal, I don't know how this song's going to try. He said, well, let's run through it. We ran through it twice, and then I put the lead sheet down, and I did it from memory from then on in. We did, I think, four takes.
Took a walk and past your house. Late last night, all the shades were pulled and drawn. Way down tight, come within a dim light cast. Two silhouettes on the shade. Oh, what a lovely couple they made.
I'll tell you when I first realized his incredible ability to pull a song out of the air. I went over to Bob's place. I had to go pick him up. We were going to do a show for Cousin Brucie at Palisades Park. And I was fooling around with the piano.
Right.
I was hitting some chords, and I was singing a few notes. So I said, Hal, what are you playing? I said, I don't know. I'm just hitting some chords, trying to find out if I can make a song out of this. He said, do it. And I played it. He said, we'll take care of that when we get back home. By the time we got to Palisades, Bob had written a song called Hope, Faith, and Dreams, which was on the back of another song that I did with the Four Seasons called An Angel Cried. That's how quick this man was. That's the kind of genius he had. So when he had Genius Incorporated on the wall in his office,
right,
he deserved that.
Thanks so much, Hal. Frank, what an interesting story.
That's exactly how we met the Rays. And that was a very long-term friendship and production situation.
The partnership with you and Bob was not just songwriting, but also, of course, production.
Definitely, and music publishing. We had four music publishing companies, all starting with the letter C, Chicory, Connolly, Cannon Point, and Claridge.
Sounds like a tongue twister to me.
Yeah.
Take them all together. Now, after the Rays, after Silhouettes, there was Billy and Lily.
Well, we were now hot. Silhouettes was not only a hit by the Rays, it was simultaneously a hit by the Diamonds. And the top 10 at the same time, and on the top 50 on Billboard, there were four versions of Silhouettes. Steve Gibson and the Redcaps made a wonderful record of Silhouettes.
And even good old Andy Griffith did a version of Silhouettes.
Took a walk and passed your house late last night.
Friends, this is a story that's near to my heart. And it's the most important thing in the whole world. More important than going to the moon or the PTA or anything. Young love.
We were coasting along on our laurels there, and we were looking for other artists. We produced a session with Billy Ford and the Thunderbirds and Lily Bryant.
And since Billy and Lily were the vocalists on the record doing a duet, that's how they were identified on the label of La-Di-Da. How did that song come about?
Bob was on a record tour promoting Silhouettes or one of the other records, and he came back from Detroit and said, what do you think of this? And he virtually wrote the entire lyric by himself. I did the middle part where you're my special bebop baby, my little bitty pretty pet and all that. That was me, but the rest of it, the whole idea was La-Di-Da, oh boy, let's go cha-cha-cha, was Bob Crew. In fact, if you think about it, you can see Bob Crew in that kind of a lyric. It followed with so Mama Line, so many of his things later on.
It is indeed a catchy song, and right now we're going to listen to a little bit of Billy and Lily with Wait a minute, hang on a second. I think there's somebody on the other phone here. Could you identify yourself?
You have Lily, of Billy and Lily.
The Lily, La-Di-Da lady. You're the one that sang that song? Wow.
Yes, I am.
What a surprise. Lily Bryant, is that right?
Lily Bryant Howard.
Lillian, okay, I almost called you Lillian, but then the group would be Billion and Lillian. Okay, Lily, we're going to get serious right now. I mean, actually, how serious can you get about a record like La-Di-Da? Great song, always loved the song, so catchy, fabulous hook, and it promoted about, I guess, 7 or 8 different songs that were also popular at that time. How did you meet Bob Crew, and Frank Slay, for that matter?
I was singing, and this gentleman was booking me in clubs, and it just so happened one club that I was booked in, there was a dancer on the show. And when she heard me, she said, you know what? I have a friend. His name is Billy Ford. And he uses 2 singers with his group, but now he only has 1. So I'm going to tell him about you.
So Billy hears about you, and what happens next?
He set the audition up. But you're talking about fate. It just so happened. On the day that he had me to come in to audition for him, Frank Slay and Bob Crew happened to be there to audition Billy. At that time, duos were a hot thing. Mickey and Sylvia had Love is Strange, da-da-da. Mm-hmm. And so they wanted their own duo. But it just so happened that the girl that Billy had with his group was sick that day. So Bob and Frank said, well, who's this young lady? So he said, well, I'm going to be auditioning her after you leave. And so Bob said, well, we want to hear what she sounds like. So I got up and I sang a few songs. They looked at one another. They went into their briefcase and pulled this song sheet out. They said, let's hear the two of you do this together. La-di-da. So Frank played the piano and Billy and I started singing la-di-da. Frank and Bob looked at one another, shook their heads. Yeah, we like that sound. We got our duo.
I'm glad, so glad, so glad, glad you are you. I'm so lucky to be. No one else but me, it's true. Cause we got you. La-di-da, oh boy, let's go. Cha-cha-cha. You're my special angel, my bebop baby, my little bitty princess. You send me with your lot of loving lips of wine, just for a baby to be my silhouette.
What was it that made Bob Crewe special?
Well, he had a very vibrant personality. I'll never forget, I think when we were recording La-Di-Da, or was it Lucky Lady? But Bob was running around the recording studio picking up different things and making different noise, different sounds, things to bang on. Yeah, because, you know, he was just very vibrant.
Lily, thank you so much for joining us. Well, Frank, it was sure nice to hear from Lily. And in addition to the Rays and Billy and Lily, you also helped develop another artist, Freddie Cannon.
A disc jockey in Boston called me, and he had a wife named Beverly, and she actually was pushing it, and sent us a tape. And it had a whole bunch of songs on it, including a song called Rock and Roll Baby.
Now, Frank, wouldn't it be great if I could just wave my magic wand and find that disc jockey who sent you that tape? I guess magic works sometimes, because guess who's on the other phone? Jack McDermott, the disc jockey, Frank, that you were just telling me about. Hi, Jack.
Well, thank you very much for including me. I was so sorry to hear about Bob's passing, and my sincere condolences go out to Bob's family. I'm sorry to hear that. Bob helped a lot of people in the music industry, including myself, and I go back to the 50s. In the 50s, I was a disc jockey in Boston, and Bob came to town with Frank Slay, his partner, and they had published a song they had recorded on Swan label. And I got to meet them and became very friendly. I started playing the record, and it got some good response in Boston. And our friendship began at that time. And they told me if I ever come across a decent talent, to send them a tape. So I did record hops around Boston at different high schools and so forth. And a lot of the local groups would come to the hops and perform to get exposure in front of the teenagers, you know?
Sure.
And many of these groups, singers, would ask me to make a demo and see if they can get started in the recording business. So my wife, Beverly, who did the record hops with me, we came across several good talented. One young man who did his song, Rock and Roll Baby, and all my hops, pleaded with me to make a demo. So we finally did. Sent the demo to Bob and Frank, and lo and behold, of all the people we sent, Bob called me back and said, Dick Clark heard Rock and Roll Baby. He loves it. He'd like to rename it Tallahassee Lassie. I said, great, which he did, and Freddie re-recorded the song in New York and took off and became a top 10 record.
Well, he comes from Tallahassee. Woo! She got a
Bob and Frank really helped launch Freddie Cannon's career. He was known as Freddie Piccarello.
His real name.
And they renamed him Cannon, Freddie Boom Boom Cannon.
Right.
And from then on, his career took off. But it was all thanks to Bob Crewe and Frank Slay. My wife and I went to New York several times and spent time with Bob, and we just thought the world of Bob Crewe. He was just so great and so talented. I can't say enough about him. I know he'll be sorely missed by his family and friends and people in the music industry.
Jack, thank you so much for joining us. Back to you, Frank, and I have a question now. Do you remember Bob Crewe playing the drum on Tallahassee Lassie?
Now, what he played, if he played anything at all, he played the bump, 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 which was when she dances to the rock, she dances to the stroller.
Was that a drum that he played? What was he playing?
Well, it was a tom-tom or a drum or whatever, heavy-sounding. Bump, 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 bump.
I think in his mind he said it was a bass drum.
Well, it could have been, but I don't recall that.
Freddie had a string of hits. Some of them you and Bob co-wrote.
Yes, many of the early ones, certainly. Dump Over and Buzz, Buzz, A Diddle It.
I love Buzz, Buzz, A Diddle It, even though I never really thought that a busy signal was Buzz, Buzz, A Diddle It. But that's one of my favorite Freddie Cannon songs. In fact, I'm imagining that I'm hearing a little bit of it right now as I talk to you.
Well, I was going down the highway to see my baby Ruth. Topping down, topping out, by my telephone. I tried to call my honey. What was the sound I had to hear?
Buzz, Buzz, A Diddle It.
Here's some endless jack, I don't know, hoping and sweet talk to my dear.
Buzz, Buzz, A Diddle It.
Yes, Frank, I sure love that one. Well, the primary reason that your partnership came to an end had to do with geography.
After I moved to Philadelphia and Bob had decided to go to Hollywood, that ended that association and others came in.
You and Bob were incredibly successful together and incredibly successful individually from that point on. Frank, we have so many wonderful people joining us on this tribute. And I'm going to close my conversation with you by asking, what was it in your mind that made Bob Crewe extra special?
Well, I would say that Bob Crewe, what made him special was the fact that he was such a free spirit. Believe it or not, he and I never had a fight over anything. I mean, it was just the smoothest relationship in business and writing and so forth. It's a tremendous loss to me. What a great friend. Really a very lovely human being.
Hearing that musical introduction, has it dawned upon you who our next guest might be? Here's a bit more.
I'm only halfway to paradise.
Well, he became much closer to paradise when he recorded this one in 1970.
Candida, we could make it.
As we salute the great Bob Crewe, I am delighted to welcome Tony Orlando.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be part of this. It's a pleasure to talk about Bob Crewe. He really was a very important part of our business. He produced and wrote songs that changed what I would call marker change. Places that you look at and say, okay, the business went to the left or to the right here because of this song or that production. And every time Bob would put his hand on a song or a production, it always was something that made the next producer say, uh-oh, I got to try and lift my bar a little bit.
Bob, in addition to being a producer and a songwriter, also was a singer. And he performed at Palisades Amusement Park. And I saw you performing there doing Halfway to Paradise and Bless You on that same stage.
I just saw a beautiful show called Beautiful in New York, which is the life story of Carole King and Jerry Goffin and Barry Mann and Cynthia Weil, and I realized that those legendary songwriters, their first hit records, and I did them both with Bruce Morrow in 1961 at Palisades Music Park. You're right, it was a wonderful time there. There was a real great spirit for music.
And on the East Coast, besides Palisades Park, there were other great venues for rock and roll acts, including a couple in Brooklyn. And one of them is where you met Bob Crewe.
I was working at the Brooklyn Fox Theater in New York City with Murray the K. And I had Halfway and Bless You. And on the bill were the following people. So you had Jerry Lee Lewis and Jackie Wilson as your closers, Smokey Robinson and the Miracles, Johnny Mathis, Little Anthony Imperials, and then the show went on from there. And we used to do 5 shows a day, and the movie would show, and then we would go on, and the movie would show, and then we would go on. So Bob Crew is standing next to Murray the K. And I said, are you Bob Crew, the writer? He said, yeah. I said, my God, I'm a great fan of yours. He said, well, where do you see this group tonight? And in come Frankie Valli and the Four Seasons. I'll never forget this. We're all standing in the wings, and out they come. And you know that straight four feel that you hear the stomping on the foot on that record? Bum, 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 bum. Well, the feet, people on the balcony were timing their stomping to that, and the balcony was literally swaying up and down. I thought the balcony was going to come down. I'd never seen anything like it. And Bob Crew turned to me and said, Tony, I said, yes, sir. I think we have a hit record here. And that was the beginning of a legendary Jersey Boys lifespan that has lasted so long. And when you go to see a Frankie Valli show, you're also seeing a Bob Crew show. Just remember that Gaudio and Bob Crew, the two Bobs, had everything to do with creating the songs, writing the songs, and producing the records. And you think about this magnificently talented man, what he gave to us, not only in terms of his song, his production value, but also finding a great artist in a man like Frankie Valli. When you turn on the radio, you'll know exactly who it is when you hear Frankie Valli. Very unique sound, right. But the truth of the matter is, Bob Crew is the head man of the crew. He is the boss. He created some of the greatest songs and greatest records I've ever heard in my life. How eclectic he was, how broad he was. I had a chance to work with Carole King, and she produced my first record.
Halfway to Paradise.
Yeah, that was Carole's, and yes. Bless You was Barry's.
Yes.
And the thing is that these people that were there in the early 60s and late 50s, when I said marker, they changed the music industry. This was pre-Beatles, and they inspired the Beatles. So when you listen to a Bob Crew song, you're listening to songs that changed the music business. Not only that were hits, they changed the music business.
Right.
And the way records were produced also. And he produced a record of mine called Yellow Pages, which was never released, unfortunately. At least I had a chance going in the studio with him and working with him. He was a genius.
Tony, thank you so much for participating in this presentation. I'll close with this question. What do you feel made Bob so extra special?
Answering that question is like trying to answer why Einstein could figure out how to split the atom. There is no answer to that. When you're talking about a genius, there's no specific reason, because most of us don't reach that level. So musically, and as a producer in popular music, he was one of those people like Einstein. Only Bob Crew knew how to split the atom. Bob was so talented that it would be difficult to narrow him down. And that's the truth about Bob Crew.
I'm just a summertime lover. I'm just a summertime guy. Well, I'm a real cold drizzle in January, but a sizzle in the month of July. Oh, don't you know now?
Now it is my distinct pleasure to bring on a summertime guy who is, in fact, a man for all seasons. The artist, formerly known as Eddie Rambo. Here he is, ladies and gentlemen, Ed Rambo.
Hi, Ronnie. How you doing? You make me sound like Prince. Speaking of Prince, that's exactly what the man we're honoring today was. He was a prince among the major music producers in the history of music.
Absolutely. And you knew that firsthand because you did several things with him. Your biggest hit ever as a songwriter was something called Navy Blue.
Well, Bob signed Diane Renee to a recording contract and needed some material for her session. So he frantically called Bud Rehak and myself to his little writing office. He called us in and he said, I need a fourth song in a hurry. So he had the title Navy Blue, and I think he had the first line. So we started to collaborate together, and I think maybe 5 to 10 minutes at most we had the song finished. and he rushed it down to Atlantic Records downstairs. We used to use their recording studios, and he recorded the song. Well, the song was released, Unbelievable Guy, as the A-side, and it was released right before Kennedy was assassinated. And, of course, the record industry died. Everything died when Kennedy was assassinated. And right after that came Thanksgiving, and then Christmas, and then New Year's, and nothing. And all of a sudden, a disc jockey up in Worcester, Massachusetts, put Navy Blue on by mistake. Instead of playing Unbelievable Guy, which was the A-side, he put the B-side on by mistake on his phone-in response. And it supposedly got the biggest response since Elvis Presley's Blue Suede Shoes, which he wrote about in the Gavin Report, and all the other disc jockeys who read the Gavin Report latched onto it and started to play it.
Blue was your biggest hit as a songwriter. Let's talk about your biggest hit as a recording artist. You were Eddie Rambeau back then. You had some competition on this one. What's the story of Concrete and Clay?
Well, Bob often visited London for a number of reasons, but primarily he was always on the lookout for good material, especially back then because it was the British invasion, so a lot of songs were coming out of England at the time. So he went over, and when he came back, he introduced me to Concrete and Clay. And he played the Unit 4 Plus 2's demo of it because they wrote the song, so therefore they recorded a demo. To be honest with you, I wasn't that thrilled with the song, but Bob insisted, so we got Charlie Colello, and Charlie Colello actually produced the record. It was one of the few that Bob didn't do of me, but Bob did find the song. And a few weeks after it was released, maybe even a week, London Records released the demo of the Unit 4 Plus 2, and the rest is kind of history. Some places played my version, other cities played theirs, and depending on where you lived, that was the hit you knew and grew up with.
Here's a little bit of your version.
You to me are sweet as roses in the morning. You to me are soft as summer rain at dawn, and love we share, that's something rare. The sidewalks in the street, the concrete and the clay beneath my feet begins to crumble, but love will never die, because we'll see the mountains tumble before we say goodbye. My love and I will be in love eternally, and that's the way, the way it's meant to be.
Having worked closely with Bob Crewe, could you tell me what it is that you found most special about Bob?
The fact that he was absolutely one of the most brilliant, not only songwriters, but producers. Bob could smell a hit, and he could smell an artist. He had this eye and this ear for talent, just anything in general with regard to the arts, because he was also quite a painter and quite an established painter as well. Towards the end of his career there, when he gave up producing, he was concentrating primarily on his art. His brilliance will go on forever because his music will live forever, and in my mind he'll live forever because he was quite a character, bigger than life and sheer genius.
I am pleased to welcome a two-faced man, now I'm saying that in the nicest of ways, who brought us a number one weather report in the mid-60s, and then, a few years later, assured all of us that he was going to get a certain lady. Now, in case I have thoroughly confused you, I will make things clear by uttering these 11 words. Two faces have I, lightning strikes, I'm going to make you mine. Welcome, Lou Christie.
Thank you very much.
Bob Crewe was not directly involved in your three top 10 hits that I mentioned, but he surely knew the importance of backup singers, and so did you. For each of those three hits, you used a different set of backup singers.
Yes, but I always knew the combination. I knew with the sound that I wanted to hear. One of my main concerns, you know, after I wrote the songs, you know, we would work on the vocals and have, you know, the ideas that we wanted. Like in the very beginning, my first records were Twyla's daughter and my sister and another friend, Kay, and they would work for me for about the first couple of years. And it was just like our hometown kids, you know, that came out of Pittsburgh.
Twyla Herbert was your co-writer on many of your big hit records. So you used those three backup singers for those records on Roulette.
Yeah. Cut in Pittsburgh, but when I started coming into New York City, if I didn't bring my other three girls called the Tammies, then we got to use and pick and choose some incredible girls, of course.
When you did Lightning Strikes, which was the number one weather report that I referred to, you had Peggy Santillia.
Peggy and Bernadette Carroll and Denise Ferry, and we had such a good time.
Your last top 10 hit came in 1969, and that was unusual because it was not written by you and Twyla. That was written by a gentleman named Tony Romeo.
Uh-huh.
I'm Going to Make You Mine. And you had yet another set of backup singers on that, Ellie Greenwich, Linda Scott, and Mikey Harris. Backup singers, a very important part of your hit records, and also the hit records of Bob Crewe. What will you most remember about Bob?
I mean, nothing but talent. The man was talented in so many ways. I mean, because he was a writer, he was a producer, he had his own way of making records. He also was artistic when he dressed, or he designed his apartment, or painted. I mean, he was just a talented person. And I thought he made some of the best records of all. When I think of the Seasons records, I don't think they could have gotten any better, you know, with the combination that people that he worked with, whether it was Charlie Colello or Bob Gaudio as the writer, or Sandy and Denny. He just knew how to make records. He had an incredible commercial ear and eye.
The next person that I'm about to introduce sang this charted record.
Here comes the boy that I love.
Well, actually, she sang it with some musical accompaniment.
Here comes the boy that I love. Here comes the boy that I love. Here comes the boy that I love. Everything about him makes me catch my eye. Don't you love the way he turns quite shy? Doesn't make a lot of money, but oh my. He's sure the boy that I love.
Any idea who this might be? I am proud to present somebody who will agree that one of the greatest things that Bob Crewe did during his illustrious career was rename her Tracy Day.
Spelled T-R-A-C-E-Y, and it had to be different. The last name is D-E-Y, Tracy Day.
Tracy
and
Day.
That's me.
T-R-A-C-E-Y-M-O, I'm sorry, D-E-Y. Okay.
Got it.
Not only was it not your real name, but it wasn't even close to your real name.
Of course. It wasn't close at all. My real name is Nora Ferrari, like the car. I'm still looking for that long-lost uncle to get a red one, but it's not happening, so...
Have you driven Ferraris in your life?
No, I have never driven them, but when I see them on the road, I go, there's my car, a red one, that's what I want.
How did it happen that you first hooked up with Bob Crewe?
Well, I was in college, and I believe it was maybe my junior year going into senior year, and did a demo, And for some reason, I can't remember exactly how it got to Bob's ears, but he heard it and he got in touch with me. And I met him and he said, you know, I think I could really give you lots of good songs and you could be a hit. And I was so excited, and we did more than a few songs, and I was very lucky to have him in my life. He really started my career.
I believe your first single was an answer to Sherry, is that correct?
Right, since Sherry had come out in such a big, big hit. He said, you know what? He said, maybe we could do an answer record to Sherry, and we'll call it Jerry, I'm Your Sherry.
Sherry!
And Bob produced this one, right?
Oh, yes.
He produced Sherry and Jerry. That one didn't make the Billboard Hot 100, but three of your records did. Here Comes the Boy, which we sampled a few seconds ago, and these two, which we're going to sample right now. Teenage Cleopatra and Gonna Get Along Without You Now.
He calls me his teenage Cleopatra. He calls me.
In addition to your solo projects for Bob Crewe, there was also a duet project, Day and Night. Bob Crewe put you, Tracy Day, together with a guy named Gary Knight, and I guess he envisioned you as kind of like a Sonny and Cher.
That's exactly what he was thinking. He said, we'll call you Night and Day.
Now, was it Night and Day or Day and Night?
Now, Ron, it's like school. I don't know.
I got it. No, it was Day and Night. I have it on my screen, Day and Night, Columbia Records. We're going to play a little bit of I'm Gonna Love You Tomorrow.
I'm gonna love you tomorrow, the way I love you today. Everything around us can change, but we gotta love you today.
I really like that one. A little bit of Day and Night. There's Tracy. Got a gentleman on the phone. Sir, did you hear that recording?
Sure, yes, I did. I kind of like that thing.
Well, I kind of like it, too. Can I ask what your name is?
My name is Gary Knight.
Oh, hi, Gary.
Hello, Tracy.
My God, I can't believe it's you. Oh, please, don't ask how old we are.
Actually,
it's only 48 years, Tracy.
Oh, my God. That's all, geez. I'm younger than I thought.
Actually, you see, I wanted to get somebody that could do a Gary Knight impersonation. We couldn't find the real Gary Knight, so I brought this guy in. You are pretty good. All right, I'm only joking.
Thank you, Ron.
This is the real Gary Knight. Gary, thank you so much for calling in. And later on in this tribute, we'll talk a little bit about something you did with one of the most exciting performers that Bob Crewe ever produced.
Sure.
Tracy, when you think of Bob Crewe, what are your most special memories?
Bob Crewe was really a genius. He had a vision. He just heard sounds that really became dynamic and hits for the people that recorded for him. The Four Seasons, of course, collaborated with him, and he wrote so many songs with Bob Gaudio. I know that he started out as a singer himself, so handsome. He was just the most handsomest man I had ever seen. He was timeless, and he was so talented and different and very versed. Didn't stay with the same thing. He kept going and creating and creating, and I think that's what really made him so special.
Next on this very special tribute to Bob Crewe, we have a former Top 40 DJ who has been the voice of the Maryland Terrapins football and basketball teams for 45 years. He also hosts a pre- and post-game show for the Washington Nationals baseball team. Welcome, Johnny Holiday.
Thank you, Ronnie. Very nice to be with you again.
You've had quite a radio career, and that's putting it mildly. Starting at the age of 17, working at WBBN in Perry, Georgia. Then you went to WFEC in Miami, then to WVRM in Rochester, and WHK in Cleveland, WINS in New York City, working closely with Murray the K, then KYA in San Francisco. Hang on a second, Johnny, I got to take a breath. You continue.
Then they transferred me to Washington in 1969, and I've been here ever since.
And two stations we should mention in Washington, D.C., WWDC and WMAL. I hope everybody's been taking notes, because now it's time for a surprise quiz. Only kidding. Wow.
Yeah, surprise quiz. Who didn't see the last Beatles concert in the United States?
You did?
I did. Johnny Holiday.
And I could also ask, who hosted WINS's final music broadcast in 1965? Could it be?
That's correct. Yours truly. Last one. The song was The Shangri-La's Out in the Streets.
Literally.
That's pretty appropriate, wasn't it?
Sure was. And switching to TV, in the mid-60s, you were the announcer of Hullabaloo and The Roger Miller Show.
Both those shows were terrific, Ronnie.
Though you never worked directly with Bob Crewe, you told me that you have a few comments that you'd like to share.
Yeah, I do, Ronnie. I met Bob in New York when I was up there on 1010 Winds from 1964, when I got there in February until they went to All News in 1965. And Bob Crewe's offices were not far away from Columbus Circle, where our station was located. I had gone over to his office many times when I got to New York. I had met him. I'd admired the guy. Not only as a writer, but, you know, he was a tremendous producer. The list goes on and on and on, and every time a record promoter would stop by our station and give it to our music director, it would be an automatic hit. He just had that magical touch, the magical feel, and you even go back to when the Rays were recording. He did Silhouettes as well, Music to Watch Girls By, Devil with a Blue Dress On, Lover's Concerto.
And all those Four Seasons hits, too.
Yeah, one of my favorites, and I guess I'd have to put this at the very top of the list, would be Can't Take My Eyes Off You. There's just nobody that writes the way that Bob Crewe wrote. I don't think anybody will ever match what he did. Boy, in my mind, Bob Crewe was a genius of a writer, producer, and performer.
That concludes part one of our tribute. Please stay tuned for part two.